This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Welcome to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. You, me, the top experts, a big issue and 28 minutes, all brought together in the virtual space that is The Briefing Room. This week, the British economy. What just happened and what's going to happen next? Last week on The Briefing Room, we looked at the long-term challenges for the British economy and how we might solve its entrenched productivity problem. This week, we're going to look at the short-term prospects for the UK in the light of the turmoil that's followed the Chancellor's unofficial budget last Friday. What exactly is causing the instability in the financial markets, and what might that mean for our economy over the next few years? Step into The Briefing Room and together we'll find out. First into The Briefing Room is the BBC's economics correspondent, Darshini David. Darshini David, let's recap. Remind us what was the aim of the government's Friday package and what the strategy was behind it.
The so-called mini budget was anything but mini. £45 billion worth of tax cuts. And that was geared primarily to boosting growth. We know that the Chancellor, Kwasi Kwarteng, has talked about wanting growth on average to be around 2.5%. Doesn't sound that big. But this is something that previous chancellors have already tried to do time and time again. Few have achieved it in recent decades, particularly since the financial crisis.
And this was, if you like, the kind of one part of it. And there was going to be more on what they call the supply side in order to get to growth.
There was indeed. Now, we had two parts of this, mainly focused on the demand side, the tax cuts. But also there were some glimpses of what we could expect in terms of supply side reform. What do we mean by that? It's basically measures which make us a more efficient economy. We can produce more at lower cost. So we're talking about things like those investment zones that we heard about, a cut in corporation tax to encourage companies to invest. All those things are meant to loosen up cash and productive resources within the economy and make us more prosperous.
Now, remind us about exactly what was announced on personal taxation.
During the leadership campaign, we heard Liz Truss come out with an increase in national insurance rates reversed. We were also going to see a pause to a planned increase in corporation tax. Now, those two things alone should have cost the taxman about £30 billion. So it was a pretty big package. On top of that, we also got the abolition of that highest rate of income tax, the 45 pence rate, a lowering of the main rate of income tax from 20 pence, and also on top of that, changes to stamp duty as well. So altogether, the biggest package we've seen for 50 years.
Right. And of course, the Chancellor also announced the help to deal with the hike in energy costs. And what was the figure for that?
We finally got some numbers put on how much it could cost on Friday. And the number was round about £60 billion in total. And I say round about because nobody actually knows, because the cost of this help will actually depend on what happens on international market for those wholesale prices for gas. And guess what? Those are so volatile. That's why we're in this position to start with.
Now, where did the announcement leave the government's finances?
Before we had this announcement, actually, relative to our GDP, our debt was actually towards the lower end of the G7. But once we see these figures coming in, economists out there are saying we could see the government having to borrow in total £400 billion to plug the gap in the next few years, which takes us into a whole new territory. You can see why there are worries about the credibility of this package.
The Office of Budgetary Responsibility, it didn't get to run its eyes over this mini budget. In previous years, would it have done?
It would have done. As you say, the OBR, as it's called, was set up to validate the government's plans. It's meant to be an independent body, so it produces the forecasts. It also rubber stamps the plans, says whether or not they're affordable, what the risks are. And it's always been headed by, frankly, people with enormous fiscal brains. So it could give the markets confidence that the kind of plans the government had were affordable, that they'd mean that the economy would become more prosperous. And frankly, we weren't overstretching ourselves.
So we get the Friday mini-budget without any OBR imprimatur. The announcements we've talked about were in it and the costs implied were in it. And how did the markets react?
The markets reacted in a way which, quite frankly, in 20 years of covering budgets, I've never seen. What we saw was the value of sterling, which had already been slipping because of a stronger dollar. That fell even further. We were looking at, you know, the lowest rates in 50 years, perhaps even longer at some points. It wasn't just the currencies, it was also the bond markets, the perhaps less glamorous end of financial markets, but a really important part because they determine the rates at which governments can borrow to pay for public services, also the rate that companies borrow at, also on top of that, the kind of interest rates you may actually face on fixed rate mortgage deals and those sort.
And how's the Bank of England reacted?
What we haven't seen from the Bank of England yet is an emergency interest rate hike. What we have seen is two things. First of all, an attempt to reassure the markets by warm words. We see that quite often when there's jitters of an extreme nature. Those then tend to have much of an impact in the longer term. But what we saw as well, and that this happened on Wednesday, is an intervention in the bond markets, because pension funds have to make sure they have enough cash and other funds to meet their liabilities. The Bank of England goes in there, puts in some of its own cash to buy up bonds. It's to stop what's been an economic issue tipping into being a widespread financial crisis. It really underlines the scale of what we're looking at.
And what's the government saying right now about whether or not it will stick to its plans and its immediate plans?
Well, you'll remember the Thatcher phrase, the lady's not for turning. And I think that encapsulates the approach we've seen from Liz Truss and her government so far. Amidst all the turmoil, the government's doubling down and saying, actually, we're going to proceed with this. We will get stronger growth as a result. But the market is not convinced at the moment. It's incredibly jittery. These kind of things haven't worked before. They're worried about the fallout, and it could mean we see an emergency interest rate rise.
Darshini David. Next, I want to find out more about what's been going on in the financial markets. Joining me in the briefing room are Toby Nangle, a former top asset manager in the City and now an economics commentator, and also Martin Wheel. Martin's a former member of the Bank of England's Monetary Policy Committee and is now Professor of Economics at King's College London. Toby Nangle, can we break down the market's initial response to the package which the government announced last Friday? What exactly spooked them?
So I think there are two things. There's the substance angle and the style angle. On the substance angle, this is the largest unfunded tax cuts in 50 years, at a time when the Bank of England is raising interest rates to cool inflationary pressure. On the style, you had the Prime Minister already putting the bank's mandate into play in the leadership election, the Chancellor refusing the offer of the OBR forecast, sacking the most senior official in the Treasury, and over the weekend just doubling down on new unfunded tax cuts.
Martin, do you agree with that? That's, if you like, a kind of combination of moves and circumstances.
Yes, I do largely agree with that. I mean, what I would add was that it wasn't just that these were unfunded tax cuts. It was that there was no sense of how the national debt was going to be put on a sustainable path, except, of course, if we get this 2.5% growth. And I don't think anyone except the Chancellor and the Prime Minister believe that the as yet unknown policies are going to deliver 2.5% growth.
In other words, there simply wasn't a belief that there was a chance of covering the extra debt incurred.
I think that's absolutely right. The implication was that tax cuts now mean higher taxes in the future, and a long-term policy of reducing taxation is simply unaffordable.
Now, Martin, let's make this as unabstract as we can. At first, the discussion about markets can seem a bit detached from ordinary life, but then banks and building societies started withdrawing mortgage deals. How did that come about?
What happened was that in markets where you can see what people expect the bank rate to be in the future, those signaled a very sharp increase in the future bank rate, and really throughout the spectrum, not just in 6 months or 9 months' time, but also, you know, up to 30 years' time. In those circumstances, obviously, mortgages are going to cost more. So the first reaction of banks and building societies is to withdraw the deals that they're currently offering. I wouldn't say that the mortgage market has been in great trouble. It's simply that we're seeing a slight hiatus, and then I expect there will be more mortgage offers again at higher rates of interest. But the Bank of England will, you know, obviously monitor mortgage rates and try and assess their implications for demand in the economy. All that feeds into the interest rate decision, which we're told will wait until the beginning of November.
Toby, as we heard from Darshini David, the bank actually intervened in the financial markets on Wednesday because of concerns about pensions. Now, can you explain to me how pensions came into this?
Okay, I'll try. It is confusing. So basically, we've been for quite a long time in a falling interest rate environment. And so the asset management industry and the pension industry came up with a way to protect pension funds from falling interest rates. And this strategy is called liability-driven investment, or LDI. It's really about protecting pension funding against changes in interest rates. Pension funds have generally been underfunded, but they've clawed that back, often using LDI and in buying other assets. LDI works really quite well in a low interest rate environment. It also works pretty well in a high interest rate environment. Where it really struggles is where you go from one to the other very, very quickly. It does leave them vulnerable to a move in 3 days in long-dated bond markets, and that's what's happened this week.
So they've been overexposed to the bond markets.
Essentially, that's right. And it got to the point where they were going to default on their financial contracts. And that would have been an unmitigated disaster.
What does a pension fund defaulting on its contracts mean?
It means that all of these hedges that they've used to protect themselves against changes in interest rates, they get wiped away. They're suddenly unhedged. And in fact, I think it's probably the case that some pension funds were wiped out and defaulted.
Okay, Martin, how alarmed do you think we should be about that pension fund problem?
I think we always have to be worried about pension funds having difficulties. I think the current intervention has alleviated the acute phase. I think the issue that everyone will be focusing on is how things proceed over the next 2 weeks, because the Bank of England wants the programme to be limited in duration. I think people would be concerned if it looked as though it was going to be a long-term programme, but pension funds have been losing money. On the other hand, of course, looking ahead, high interest rates do solve many of the pension fund problems of how to pay for future benefits out of future contributions.
Martin, the money that the bank has put in to help, is that money which is lost, or is it money that can come back to the exchequer?
Well, as I understand it, it's money that can come back to the exchequer. The Bank of England has been buying in long-dated securities, and then eventually, you know, in the not-too-distant future, we hope it will want to sell them again. Of course, the question is whether they get as much for them when they sell them as they've paid when they buy them. But the Treasury has issued an indemnity, so if the Bank of England does make a loss, of course, it will be the taxpayer who pays.
Right. I think from what you've both said, it may be that the Bank of England action has solved this problem for the moment. Martin, can we just look at the bigger question, the relationship between government policy and Bank of England policy? Are the Bank of England, with its desire to control inflation, and the government, with its desire for growth, are they essentially at odds?
Well, as far as I can see, they are at odds. The Bank of England has been trying to restrain demand. The government seems to have decided that by adding to demand, it will generate a sharp increase in the rate of growth of productivity. And as I said earlier, I don't think anyone outside the government believes that's going to happen, but it does mean that the government has been topping up demand while the Bank of England has been trying to restrain it. And of course, with the instructions given to the Bank of England that it has a 2% inflation target, it's going to go on trying to restrain demand.
Toby, the image this creates, for me at any rate, is that the harder the bank tries in one direction, the harder the government has to try in the other direction.
Yeah, that's what the financial markets are telling you. The government's trying in one direction and the bank has to do equal offsetting moves in the other direction. And that's what's driving up mortgage rates. That's what's causing problems in the pension market.
Martin, do you think that the market's view of the risk that the UK represents has undergone a significant shift?
Yes, I do. I think fundamentally the market is concerned that the inflation target may have to be eased so as to make it possible to manage the increased level of debt that the government seems to want. The consequence of that is that money loses its value faster, so people demand a higher interest rate to make up for that.
Toby Nangle, what needs to happen to stabilise things?
I think the Bank of England has stabilised the situation in the short term. The longer term dynamic, the market is looking to the Chancellor and the Prime Minister to see whether they row back some of their announcements, whether they maybe come through and slash public services and expenditure on public services as a way to make good on their fiscal promises. I mean, that might be a bad outcome for people, but for the markets, that would close the gap.
Toby Nangle there and Martin Wheel. Lastly, what does all this mean for us in what the government calls the medium term, i.e. up to the likely date of the next general election? Stepping into the briefing room are Stephanie Flanders, senior economics editor at Bloomberg, and Chris Giles, economics editor of the Financial Times. Chris Giles, can we look at what's currently scheduled to happen in November?
Well, in November, at the start of the month, we're scheduled to have on the 3rd the Bank of England's next meeting. And then on the 23rd of November, later in the month, we'll have a government statement, its fiscal target, so how what it wants for the public finances. And we'll also get the forecasts from the Office for Budget Responsibility, the fiscal watchdog, to see whether everything adds up.
And what do you think the forecast from the OBR is likely to say?
In the short term, I think the OBR will show there's an eye-watering amount of government borrowing. And then in the longer term, this is where it's really interesting because the government will be desperate to show that public debt is coming down as a share of the size of the national economy. So I think we might well see some penciled in big public spending cuts late on in the period, which is sort of 2026, 2027. So it's way after the next election. So you can pencil them in now and they probably will never happen.
Right. OK. Stephanie, do you broadly agree with that?
Yeah, I mean, we're obviously looking at inflation's going to be actually lower in the sort of short term of the forecast because the energy package takes about 4 or 5 percentage points off inflation rate just by holding down energy costs when they would otherwise have gone higher. But then higher inflation further out, not just because inflation has got higher since the last time they did a forecast, but also because you've now had this fall in the pound, which makes imported goods more expensive. Just to put in perspective what Chris was saying about the increase in borrowing, not just borrowing, but the borrowing costs, the average interest rate on the government debt back in March when the Office of Budget Responsibility last reported was around 1.8%. Earlier this week, it was 4.8%. It's gone down a little bit. That is an enormous increase in just the cost of servicing that debt, probably an extra £15 billion a year to add on to the cost of the energy package and everything else. So that is a lot of red ink. And I agree also with Chris that they will need to have significant spending cuts built in somewhere in the programme in order to stick to what the Chancellor has said he's absolutely going to do, which is to have debt falling relative to the size of the economy. And we reckon, Bloomberg Economics, we think somewhere in the range of £40 to £50 billion a year, depending on how optimistic you are about the growth of the economy, is going to be needed in order to achieve that falling debt target. Which, by the way, is a bit more than what George Osborne said he was going to do in 2010.
In other words, it's austerity plus.
austerity plus, when you've already done, I'm sure people didn't consider it to be the low-hanging fruit, but when you've done the somewhat easier things that George Osborne did in the years of austerity.
Chris, when we talk about that level of spending adjustments, what areas are we necessarily talking about?
You will not get it from efficiency savings. You're talking about big cuts to health, education, and particularly when the government wants to spend more on defence, justice, policing, all of these services can expect to have some big cuts. Again, not immediately, because the government said it's going to stick to its spending plans until 2024-25. So that gets it through to the election. But severe austerity in the second half of the decade.
And just to say, sorry, on that short term, though, they have said they're sticking to the cash totals for spending that have already been agreed for the next 2 years. Those were set, obviously, with much lower expectations for inflation. So although we're not going to be cutting the plans, you're still looking at what will be extremely tight for public services, facing much higher costs, having to stick to the same cash budget. That might feel pretty austere, even though those bigger cuts that we've been talking about were not yet in view.
And you agree with Chris, presumably, about what those big ticket items are. In other words, you don't just get away with saying we're going to have a few efficiencies here and there, and we're going to cut a bit of red tape here and there and sack a couple of civil servants.
Well, the easiest thing to do, which has been a time-honoured approach of chancellors in the past, is to cut public investment. You stop building hospitals, schools, or the renovation programmes for schools, you know, the electrification of the country or the railways, road building. It's all those classic things. And we know from history that when you cut public sector investment, that has a much bigger impact on growth than other kinds of cuts.
In other words, it limits growth.
Yes.
Chris, let's go back to the question what the Bank of England is going to be doing. What level of interest rate do you think we can anticipate just between now and the end of the year? And what effect does that have?
The official rate is 2.25% now. There's two meetings scheduled before the end of the year. And I think we could be somewhere above 3.5%, but maybe even 4% by the end of the year. If the Bank of England wants to show that it is serious about offsetting the inflationary impact of the government's tax cuts, it will have to do that. That's what markets are expecting. So if it doesn't do that, it risks having an adverse market reaction that markets, in some sense, don't think the Bank of England is sufficiently independent. It's maybe doing the government's bidding. It's maybe not wanting to offset a budget that financial markets don't really like. So I think the Bank of England is under enormous pressure to show that it's tough. And that means quite high interest rates pretty quickly.
And Stephanie, presumably that will stabilise the pound.
I think you've certainly got, at the moment, there's just a lot of momentum against the pound, which is not going to dissipate anytime soon. I think it's quite possible. Certainly many people in the markets, it's about 50-50, the bets on whether or not it'll get below the $1, you know, parity. That's sort of psychologically important. But what I would say is I think they've lost a bit of room for manoeuvre that they had from their credibility, and they don't want to lose any more. You know, over the years, they've actually been able to have, unlike many other central banks, they've been exceeding their inflation target. The markets have been willing to live with that and believe them when they said we're going to look through these inflation rates and we'll get it back in the future. They don't want to lose the ability to do that. And the risk, as Chris says, is if they start looking like they're not independent and they're allowing, in a sense, the government to print money to get itself out of trouble, that could be very risky.
Chris, that's the big picture stuff before the end of the year. What about the small picture stuff? In other words, what the individual, the mortgage holder and so on, may experience between now and the end of the year?
Well, I think if you are either on a variable rate mortgage or your fixed rate is coming up for renewal, you will find that it is far, far more expensive. I just looked at mine this morning, in fact, and realised that if my fix was coming to an end, I would have to pay three times what my mortgage is fixed at. And even though I'm very far up the income distribution, I'm not in financial difficulties, my jaw did drop. For the population as a whole, the numbers of people who are coming to the end of their fix is pretty large every year. And so there will be a large number of middle class people of working age who will be having a very, very unpleasant time in the next few months, unless mortgage rates come down from where they currently are.
Okay,
Let's now look at beyond the new year and what we might call the medium term, next couple of years. Chris, how much growth was the government looking for? Remind us. And what are the chances that it will achieve it?
When we're looking in the medium term, so a couple of years ahead, it wanted to raise the growth rate from roughly 1.5% a year to roughly 2.5% a year. So that would be a very, very welcome ambition if it was achieved. And it would solve quite a lot of problems. It wouldn't solve all problems, because if you grow more, people will expect higher wages. So that puts more pressure on public services in some respects. But it would certainly allow government to have more money, because you get more tax revenues in, and would make people feel better off. So the ambition is fine. The trouble is, this isn't the first government to have an ambition to increase the long-term growth rate. In fact, I don't know of any government that didn't have that ambition. What's difficult is actually achieving it, not having a target.
Stephanie, do you broadly agree with that? And what are the obstacles in the way of achieving that level of growth?
The two most important things for what the economy is doing in a couple of years' time, regardless of whether we achieve that higher long-term growth target, will be the state of the global economy. What's happened to energy prices? Did we have a bad winter? Did we bring down inflation because there was a resolution in the situation in Ukraine, which doesn't seem likely? And the state of the UK consumer confidence, whether people feel able to spend, whether they feel they've got through the worst. Those aren't necessarily, certainly the first of those is not something that the government control. But when you go further out, Chris is right that it's a bit like the magic money tree, only it's even tougher. You don't just get to say we're going to have 2.5% growth a year. There's no country in Europe actually that has a long-term potential growth rate of 2.5%, because we're all getting older for a start. So you don't have the growth in the labour force. If we're not going to see the big immigration necessarily that we've had in the past that has helped support, you know, grow our population and sort of grow the overall size of the economy, it is a little bit difficult to see how you get the 2.5. And it should be said, the Office for Budget Responsibility's own assumption of our long-term growth rate is around 1.8. So the figures also look tougher. We actually think that the long-term potential growth rate is more like the low ones, 1.2% maybe, which is perfectly respectable for a country of this size. But it's certainly not going to allow us to catch up and make up the ground we've lost in the last few years.
Chris, final impossible question. Where do you think that the next government, presuming it takes over towards the end of 2024, beginning of 2025, where do you think it will be in terms of the economy?
Well, I think it does depend a lot on what happens to gas prices, and so what happens in the war in Ukraine, and that's also obviously very difficult. But if we abstract from that just for a second and just look at the big things that we know about, they'll be faced with an ageing population, with a lot of more pressures on public services. The public finances are weak and are not likely to be much stronger at that stage. And the public will not feel that their prosperity has gone up very much in the past decade or so. So there'll be a great yearning for a new government to change things, and maybe not a lot of ability to do so.
So I think there's two other groups we should think about. There's anyone on benefits will be waiting to see whether they come through on Rishi Sunak's commitment to raise benefits next year in line with inflation, which would be on the order of potentially around 10%. That would have an enormous impact to those households dependent on benefits. The other one, which is much closer to the other end of the pay spectrum and much closer to Conservatives, a lot of people will have had their retirements postponed by what's happened in the last week and certainly the last few weeks. They will look in their ISAs and in their pension plans, and they will see that the value of the bonds, the gilts, the government IOUs that are sitting in all of those plans have gone down by roughly a third since the start of the year. That is a massive hit to value in savings that they thought were safe. So I think if you don't want to have a fright, certainly don't think about what your mortgage might be when you renegotiate, and don't look at your pension for a while.
Stephanie Flanders there with Chris Giles. My thanks to them, to Darshini David, Toby Nangle and Martin Wheel. We'll be back next week. The Briefing Room was presented by me, David Aronovich. It was produced by Octavia Woodward, Dan Gordon and Simon Watts. The studio manager was Neil Churchill and the editor was Richard Varden. And if you enjoyed this episode of The Briefing Room, there are many others to listen to on BBC Sounds. for example, you can tune in to the companion piece to this programme, our look at the UK economy's long-term productivity problem. But if you fancy something completely different, there's a programme about drones and what they could mean for the future of warfare.
Hello, I'm John Wilson, and I'm here to tell you about my podcast series, This Cultural Life. In each episode, I ask leading artistic figures to reveal the most important people, events, and cultural works that have had a profound impact on their own creativity.
It was just so different. It was so away from everyone. It just blew my mind.
I didn't know about this. I just was confronted by it. And to me, this was art, you know? I felt art.
We didn't know we were going to be there for years. But I mean, I honestly would have shot that thing for 5 years. I didn't care.
People like Nicole Kidman, Goldie, Armando Iannucci, Jarvis Cocker, Hannah Gadsby, Tracy Emin, Paul McCartney, and James Corden.
It means a great deal to me, that show. You realise how extraordinarily uplifting it can be to share an experience with 1,500 people.
The people whose work we love talking about the work that they love. Search for This Cultural Life on BBC Sounds.
I'm very emotional now. Thank you, John.